The finale of the Symphony in D by Juan Arriaga, played there by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Juanjo Mena. And that's it for another Sunday morning. I do hope you've enjoyed what you've heard and it's set you up for a pleasant Sunday afternoon. Do tune in again next week if you can, anytime from 9 o'clock. Sunday Morning is a tandem production for BBC Radio 3. Thanks to my producer, Sam Phillips, and our studio manager in Broadcasting House, Nasser Pervez.
Radio 3 presents a week of live performances from one of the cultural capitals of the UK, Manchester. There are concerts showcasing five of the city's orchestras and ensembles, from Mighty Mahler with the Halle Orchestra to boundary-breaking sounds from the Manchester Collective, every weekday evening at 7:30. And live chamber music from Stoller Hall in the city's world-renowned Cheetham School of Music on Tuesday to Friday lunchtimes at 1. Manchester Week begins tomorrow evening at 7:30 on Radio 3 and on BBC Sounds.
Well, it's a minute after midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the actress Catherine Parkinson.
Years out of drama school and heavily in debt, Catherine Parkinson was offered a part in a new television comedy series, The IT Crowd. As all fans of the cult series will know, she plays Jen, the hopeless boss of two computer geeks. She's the so-called normal one. The series ran from 2006 to 2013 with audiences of 2 million. For Catherine Parkinson, it made her career, winning her a British Comedy Award and a BAFTA. Since then, Catherine's appeared in everything from stage productions of Sophocles and Chekhov to television sci-fi drama Humans, as well as Doc Martin and the sitcom The Kennedys. She's also moved into writing. Her play about three people sitting for a painter premiered on television during lockdown. Catherine, Jen's a woman who's trying to behave like a boss. She's utterly hopeless, isn't she, and has absolutely no understanding of what's happening in her company. And yet somehow she never gets found out, does she?
No, it was very difficult, obviously, for me to channel somebody who is bluffing like that in life. She's somebody who has got the job of head of IT and she doesn't even know what it stands for. and that was fun to play and easy.
It was a role that actually required you to sing too, because especially when you fell in love. In fact, here you are with co-star Richard Ayoade, warbling away.
I love him, oh, no. I love him, I love him.
Goodness me. What would you term what just happened there?
Norman says my voice is extraordinary.
He's right.
Wow, I just triggered my own tinnitus.
This is a long song.
Sorry to spring that on you. We're not going to require you to sing today. I see from your list you've brought us music by John Tavener, George Gershwin, Thomas Tallis, but we're going to begin with an 18th century Italian aria. And I think this was something you learned during your singing lessons at drama school. Did you manage to sound anything like Cecilia Bartoli?
Oh, exactly like her. And it's very apt that you just played that clip from The IT Crowd, because that's sort of the voice I channeled, I think, at drama school. And I remember kindly being told to try and access my own voice. And I didn't know quite what they meant by that. But with Cecilia Bartoli, it's the elegance of her singing and the integrity of it. That was something, alas, I didn't have the talent to do. But I loved this song. I sang it at drama school. And for about 10 minutes of my time there, I felt like I was, you know, destined to be a singer.
So when we play Caro Mio Ben by Giordani, you would rather prefer to hear the Bartoli version than your own?
You know, I'm happy to sing along if that's something that you want. But why don't we give her a go first?
Cecilia Bartoli with Caro Mio Ben by Tommaso Giordani. The pianist was George Fisher. Catherine Parkinson, I imagine that it must be very helpful to have done some singing, some music for a career in acting.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think most actors feel they can perform a song even if they haven't got quite as much singing ability as they would like. But I am someone who's always just admired and envied people with musical talent, because I can see it even in my husband, who doesn't play an instrument but can play his teeth. He can play Flight of the Bumblebee, amongst others, on his teeth, who's just got a perfect ear. And I think I can see it in one of my daughters too, where she finds it hard to sing out of tune, whereas my issue has always been managing to stay in tune. I mean, I did play the oboe as a child, but again, that was my mum loved the oboe and didn't stop to consider that my teeth were extremely sticky outy, and I struggled to even get my lips around the teeth to get onto the reed. So the lessons were just a waste of time. I barely got a note out, you know. So I like to think that maybe if she'd chosen a different instrument, I might have got further. But
The trombone
or the cello.
You've played serious roles as well as comedy all through your career. And I wonder how acting Chekhov or Sophocles perhaps helps with comedy, or is it the other way around? Does comedy help with Chekhov?
Sophocles, for example, I feel confident in saying it isn't hilarious, whereas Chekhov is. I did read classics at university, so, you know, really loved the humour in things like Aristophanes and Terence. But I think doing Greek tragedy is actually quite challenging for an actor with comic abilities. I prefer to do things where there is comedy. Otherwise, I worry that I'll be accidentally funny, because I don't think comic ability is something you're necessarily in control of. I sometimes think that you learn to control it so that you feel in charge of it. I used to think how humiliated I'd feel if I ran for a bus and tripped up. And I thought, maybe my self-consciousness about that has meant that I've learned to get the laugh in first so that I'm not laughed at. Maybe it's a fear of being laughed at that means you sort of learn to control it. But yeah, I like to do things that have comedy in them. Otherwise, I just sort of think, yeah.
Is it, if you've got this ability, which you clearly have, to make people laugh, is it hard when you're doing serious work not to be funny, or a relief not to have to?
That's exactly it. I mean, I did do Iphigenia Aulis as a student at Oxford, and I think I was hilarious accidentally in the role of Clytemnestra. Certainly, there were laughs that weren't intended.
Music now, which you fell in love with as a teenager, I think. John Tavner's The Protecting Veil, his hymn of praise to the Mother of God, who's given voice by the cello. And you particularly admired this cellist, Natalie Klein, when you saw her win the BBC Young Musician of the Year in 1994. She was 16, and I guess you were much the same age.
I was much the same age. I think that's right. That would have been part of it. And I remember watching her. I've always loved the cello, the sound of it, but just watching how organic her performance was very striking to me. And I remember it was the first time I had been moved to tears by something that wasn't wholly relevant to my life, you know, something outside of myself. And I wanted to be her in that moment, I suppose.
Natalie Klein was the cellist in music from John Taverner's The Protecting Veil, with Stephen Layton conducting the English Chamber Orchestra, music that I think takes you back to your school days, Catherine Parkinson. You went to a highly academic state school in Kingston-upon-Thames and then read classics at Oxford. You've said it was the hardest thing you've ever done. Why was that?
I always felt, I have to say, like a fraud, really, doing that. I was always somebody who talked her way through tutorials without having read enough of the texts. I tried to pass off C. Day Lewis's translation of the Aeneid as my own. You know, it was just I was a joke as a classic student. What I discovered later on in my fourth year was philosophy, and I wish I'd discovered it sooner, because that's a subject that I felt less for. There's a lot of creativity, I think, in philosophy, whereas with classics, there's no point doing an essay about Plato's Republic if you haven't read it. I found out to my cost. But, yeah.
Quite a few comedians read classics at university. Andy Zaltzman, Natalie Haynes spring to mind. I mean, I wonder if that's a coincidence, or perhaps there's something about the subject that lends itself to comedy.
I think there's a sort of willful perversion in choosing classics a little bit, because it's a subject that slightly defies categorisation, because it manages to combine literature and philosophy and history, and that's partly why I chose it. I think possibly there is something that draws people who are trying to defy categorisation, perhaps. Also, there's a lot of drama and humour involved in the classics. Perhaps that's not known. It's a great subject. I don't regret it for a second, but I do regret wasting the time of really eminent and brilliant tutors. I can remember, you know, being asked if I'd read the Xerox and saying I loved Xerox. I thought he was a wonderful writer until she told me that it was a photocopier. You know, I mean, I was a joke. But I wanted to do acting, and I'm from a lower middle class background, so absolutely did not know any actors. And there was a kind of expectation to go for a safe job and a job that had longevity and a pension and everything else. And there was an act of bravery, at least, I think, on my part at some point to say, no, this is what I love and I want to do it and take the risk. I certainly didn't have any financial background to depend on. And I do at least applaud myself for that when I was younger, because that was a bold and reckless step that I feel has paid off. And it's only now that I'm an actress that I feel like I'm not a fraud. So well done for that, at least.
Well, talking of bold and reckless, I wonder if you can recall your gap year before university. And you'll know why I've brought that up.
I do remember my gap year was mainly working in TGI Fridays in Kingston-upon-Thames, being in charge of the ice creams, the desserts, and being told off because my long ginger curly hairs kept falling into the desserts and being brought back. Yeah, that was the main portion of my gap year, was earning money to go and live in Florence for a few months. And then when I got back from that, which was a wonderful time, and I'd spent most of that time listening to with my little personal stereo to Cinema Paradiso. The film had come out not long before, and I just listened to that, well, all the whole tape, but particularly the first song on train journeys around Italy. And then when I came back, I went on my last sort of holiday with my brothers and my mum and dad. It was just a sort of coach trip, really, through Europe. My mum studied Russian at Queen's Belfast, where she met my dad, and she is a big Russia obsessive. And we were on a sort of bumpy coach ride through the Russian steppe, I remember, and I was listening to Cinema Paradiso. So I absolutely love that piece of music. It was essentially the end of my childhood when I was 18 and about to embark on the unknown at university and beyond.
Thank you.
Cinema Paradiso, Ennio Morricone's soundtrack to the 1988 film. Catherine Parkinson, in 2019, you were nominated for an Olivier Award for your role in Home, I'm Darling, by Laura Wade, a play about a 21st century woman who takes redundancy and decides to live like a 1950s housewife. This must have been a fascinating challenge.
It was a challenge for many reasons, not least because I had to do a lot of housework on stage really well. And I remember my husband coming to see it and being quite peeved because I don't do a lot of that at home. And yeah, I think he thought it was just sheer inadequacy, but he could see that I could actually do it quite well. Yeah, I love doing that play, not least because we had a wonderful music design with some quite unusual songs from the period. But yeah, I've quite often played quite shambolic characters. Quite often I've played characters with drink problems on stage and sort of people that are a bit sad and despairing and, you know, sort of funny in a defensive way. But Judy is somebody who's all about control and held and very pristine. And, you know, the carriage of my body had to be very, you know, sort of like a dancer. And so it was a very different physicality to the one I'm used to accessing on stage, yeah.
It's quite an unforgiving dissection of the fetishization of wifeliness, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's quite a bold play. I think it's saying that a modern relationship is a jive and you need to both kind of make it work for the other person. And if one person decides to... Judy is hiding and she's removing herself from work. She's hiding away and that's not good for her or her marriage. Although the idea of being brought a cocktail and your slippers after a day's work might be superficially appealing, I think it's saying that feminism is good for all of us and that with feminism and choices and women working and women having careers, it's evened up relationships and put us all in the same world of work and home. And that's been good for us all and good for marriages.
Laura Wade wrote the part with you in mind, didn't she?
Yeah, so it's a good job I played it.
But I think the fascinating thing about it is that what starts as a sort of fun experiment has become, in a way, both prison and a denial of reality. So it's saying very serious things about domestic life being a trap, isn't it?
Lots of people have fetishised the sort of 50s, sort of being in love with the clothes and the teapots. It's become a sort of post-feminist thing to indulge in that sort of lifestyle. And some people say, well, it's a feminist choice if I want to do that. But I suppose Laura's saying, well, our forebears have worked hard for us to have choices and to not misrepresent the past, whitewash the past, because it was harder for women when they didn't have choices. Hmm.
I know your mother, Janet, loves this next music. It's by Thomas Tallis.
Yeah, this I chose this just because my mum has informed my taste in pretty much everything from my earliest beginnings in Hanworth, in Isleworth. My mum was always playing Radio 3 on the radio and always listening to Thomas Tallis, and she introduced me to Elvis Presley and Joan Armatrading and Joan Baez and Maria Callas and Thomas Tallis.
Oh.
Jeremy Somerley directing the Oxford Camerata in Salvator Mundi by Thomas Tallis. You can find details of all Catherine Parkinson's music if you visit the Private Passions webpage. You can also find hundreds of previous editions of the programme on BBC Sounds, including Jan Ravens and Harry Enfield. Catherine, you're married to another actor, Harry Peacock, and you've appeared together in the sitcom The Kennedys. When two actors are married to each other, is there a degree of rivalry sometimes?
Not with us. To Harry's credit, Harry is the son of actors and is perhaps not your typical actor. I think there are lots of competitive actors, but he is not one. I have to kick him out the door to go to an audition, to be honest. No, we're not competitive at all. I've been with him now for nearly 20 years, which just seems wrong. I remember when we first met, we were doing a workshop at the National of the Bulgakov book, The Heart of a Dog, and he was playing the dog, and he was amazing at playing a dog. And he, when we started to go out shortly after, I remember he brought me over. He had a suitcase and he said, "I've got you something really special." And I was quite excited that it might be some jewellery or something. And he just had some pear and some cheese. And he wanted to just sort of show me, because I hadn't had fruit with cheese before. But he also introduced me to various bits of music, and Porgy and Bess was one of them. This was back in the days of sort of mixtapes and things. So it was a tape he bought me, and I first just used to listen to it as a sort of straightforward love song. I've always been a big fan of Nina Simone anyway, but I didn't know the story of the opera, the plot of the opera, and I think that explains just why it's so tender, and the sort of self-knowledge of Bess not being able to get away from the man. It's a beautiful, beautiful song that reminds me of when I met him.
Let him handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I wanna stay with you forever, and I'll be glad. Yes, I love you, Porgy. Don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me with his hot hands. If you can keep me, I want to stay here with you forever. I've got my man. It's going to be like dying. when he calls me, but when he comes, I know I'll have to go.
Nina Simone with I Loves You, Porgy, from Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, and the track features on her 1959 album Little Girl Blue. Catherine Parkinson, your father-in-law was the actor Trevor Peacock, who sadly died last year, much loved, of course, for his role as Jim Trott in The Vicar of Dibley, but also an acclaimed Shakespearean actor. To what extent was he a role model for you, somebody who successfully made a career in both serious drama and comedy?
A role model, I suppose, but I just loved him. He was my... I loved him. He was second father to me, Trevor. And he had a very interesting musical life because his father, Victor, had been an organist and he had just watched the organ being played and, you know, self-taught. And Trevor never read music, but he wrote songs like Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter, and Gossip Calypso, and I Want to Walk You Home. And he just recorded them straight into a recorder with the lyrics and the music. And a lot of people obviously know him for his acting, and not just Vicar of Dibley, but, you know, Titus Andronicus and Feste. And when Trevor was in the army, he visited Oxford and he met Jack Good. And I think for a while they worked at the windmill together between the... strippers, they had to come on and do a sort of double act. And I remember him telling me that was a very difficult job to keep them entertained. And, and then helped Jack Good set up 6-5 Special, which was a sort of precursor to the Top of the Pops. It was the idea was that it would be a live show, which was quite radical, I think. And the audience would be in amongst the band. And they got people like Little Richard on, and there's a clip with Trevor with the Beatles doing a sketch out in the 6-5 Special on YouTube. And I think they tried to get Elvis on but didn't manage to, I remember him saying. But he had a massive musical talent and loved nothing better than after dinner, you know, having listening to the Gypsy Kings or any classical music. He loved classical music, and I always knew he heard it in a way that I didn't. I, like anyone, love music. And one of the reasons I love doing theatre is because it's an excuse to listen to music for about an hour and call it my warm-up in my dressing room and sing at the top of my voice. And I realised when I don't do theatre, that's sort of what I'm missing most in my life. But I've always known that Trevor and my husband hear music in a different way. And yeah, and Trevor, before I met him, when I was about 25, when I met Harry, I had been cast rather boldly by Lambda as Feste in Twelfth Night, you know, way before, you know, giving the girls boys' parts was a thing. They were very ahead of the game. And I was truly, I mean, I really was dreadful as Feste. I had to sing those beautiful songs and I floundered a bit and for some reason kept peeling an apple in role. I don't know why. But I watched Trevor on YouTube as Feste, I remember, and thought he was just the definitive clown. Sang those songs so beautifully, and he always had a sense of comedy as well in his being, and just had a huge lovability and charisma, you know, an ability to have quite a dark charisma as well as a comic one, and a wonderful voice.
And obviously a huge influence on you. Well, here he is singing as Feste in the BBC production of Twelfth Night.
When and I was but a little tiny boy, with a hay. Oh, the wind and the rain. A foolish thing was but a toy. For the rain, it raineth every day. But when I came to man's estate with a hay, oh, the wind and the rain, gainst knaves and thieves men shut their gate. For the rain, it raineth every day, it raineth every day. But when I came, alas, to wive with a hay, the wind and the rain, by swaggering could I never thrive. For the rain, it raineth every day. But when I came to my beds with a hay, oh, the wind and the rain, with toss but still had drunken him. For the rain, it raineth every day, it raineth every day. A great while ago, the world begun with a hay. Oh, the wind and the rain, but that's all one, our play is done. And we'll strive to please you every day, to please you every day.
The rain, it raineth every day, a setting by Joseph Horowitz. Trevor Peacock as Feste in the 1980 BBC television production of Twelfth Night. Catherine Parkinson, your first play, Sitting, about three people sitting for a painter, premiered on television during lockdown. What inspired you to move from acting to writing your own play?
I actually was approached to do it. I was approached by the BBC to try and write something, and I've always been somebody who is good at responding to orders and being told to pull my finger out and do it. I'm not sure I would have done it otherwise, but really enjoyed it. So that is motivating me on its own now.
But you were able also to look into your own experience. All writing is personal, but one of your characters has had a suicide in the family, and that's something that sadly happened in your own family. So I wonder whether writing the play was a kind of form of therapy for you.
A form of therapy, but also perhaps a way of communicating with family members without talking in such bold terms about things. I think therapy culture is wonderful, but my own experience and people in my family's experience, I think, is that some things are too painful, perhaps to... sometimes it's better to talk in a slightly... Once removed way about things that are too unresolvable, I suppose.
There's been such a change over the last couple of years in attitudes towards women working on screen, on the stage, thanks partially to the Me Too campaign. What changes have you noticed in the way people are working now?
Just that there is an official place for people to go, particularly younger actors and actresses, if they are concerned about anything from bullying to harassment, and just that there is, yeah, a place where they can feel they can report things like that. That's huge, because it's an industry where boundaries can be blurred quite easily because of what you're required to do often. And intimacy coordinators, which I've had a lot of experience with recently, you know, these things, you sort of think, why weren't they in place before? Why didn't we get there sooner? But it's great progress, and more women writing is also massive and welcome.
So do you think women feel safer?
I think they do. I mean, I know that I would have felt safer as a younger actor. Now that I'm older, you know, you find your voice and you know that you wouldn't tolerate certain things that you weren't sure whether you should tolerate when you were younger. So I hope so. I certainly feel like it looks like that, yeah.
We're going to end with some more polyphony. This is music you heard while filming in Georgia, and they have wonderful singing there. What was it that made you particularly take note?
Well, Georgia, I absolutely fell in love with. I did a film there directed by Rudolf Herzog a few years ago, and I took my parents, my children, my husband, my mother-in-law, we all fell in love with it. Tbilisi and Kazbegi, for different reasons. They have huge banquets with dumplings, kingali and kachapuri, the cheesy cornbread. And then they suddenly burst organically and very unself-consciously into song. And, you know, I missed that, having left school. There isn't a lot of opportunity to just sing in a group. And the polyphonic singing is absolutely beautiful, as is the Georgian dancing. And it just absolutely staggered us. And I've listened to it ever since. But, yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Catherine Parkinson, for sharing your private passions. Just give us one last piece of advice. If you were that young actress starting off as you were then, what sort of advice would you find helpful, do you think? And what would you pass on to somebody now?
I think I would have told myself to have written sooner and to have not judged myself for wanting to do that, to have just got on with it.
Is it therein that lies the real Catherine Parkinson, do you think?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Well, while you think about it, we'll say goodbye and leave you with Chuck Rulo and the Sinandali Choir. Catherine Parkinson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
the Sinindali Choir with Chakrulo, a Georgian polyphonic folk song. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Catherine Parkinson. The episode was produced by Jane Greenwood and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. The programme returns next Sunday at noon when Michael Barclay will be in conversation with the poet George Surtees. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio and on BBC Sounds. It's just coming up to 1 o'clock. Time for the news, read by me, Vijay Alice. The Deputy Prime Minister, Dominic Raab, has urged the former minister, Nuz Ghani, to make a formal complaint about her allegation. She was told her Muslim faith was a reason for her being sacked in 2020. She also says she was told it would damage her career if she pursued the matter. The Conservative chief whip, Mark Spencer, has said he was the man Ms. Ghani spoke to, but called the claims false and defamatory. Downing Street says the Prime Minister also spoke to her at the time and invited her to make a complaint, but she did not do so. Russia has accused the UK of provocation and spreading disinformation following claims by the Foreign Office that Moscow was plotting to install a new government in Ukraine. The man said to be in line to take over, the former Ukrainian MP Yevhen Muraev, also dismissed the claims. An advisor to the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said the British allegation needed to be taken seriously. Thousands of Russian troops are massed on the border with neighbouring Ukraine. Pope Francis has expressed concern about the increased tensions over Ukraine. Addressing a crowd at the Vatican after Sunday prayers, the Pope said the situation threatened the security of Europe with even wider repercussions. A 16-year-old boy has been stabbed to death in Manchester. The boy was found with stab wounds in Stretford yesterday evening and taken to hospital, where he died. Four teenagers have been arrested on suspicion of murder. Fighting in northern Syria between Islamic State militants and Kurdish fighters backed by US-led coalition forces is continuing for a fourth day. The Kurdish-led SDF has been tightening its siege of a prison housing thousands of suspected IS members in the city of Hasaka. Several civilians are among the dead. The Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinta Ardern, has announced that as a result of her country's new coronavirus restrictions, she is delaying her wedding. The latest measures include limits of 100 fully vaccinated people at events or 25 people at venues not requiring vaccine passes. New Zealand is expected to reach 1,000 cases a day in the coming weeks. And finally, a look at the weather. Cloudy for most parts of the UK this afternoon, with sunny spells in Wales and northeastern Scotland. Showers will continue in the northwest of England. Temperatures can be expected to reach 9 Celsius in the Highlands, 8 in Belfast and Edinburgh, 7 in London and down to 5 Celsius in Cardiff. That is the BBC News and Weather at 1:05 past 1.
Great music comes in many shapes and forms, whether it be lush romantic symphonies or ethereal medieval chant. The purity of a Baroque aria or a contemporary masterpiece. If we think it's good, you'll hear it on Essential Classics. Part of the joy of the show is discovering music, a piece you've never come across before, or hearing a new interpretation of a real classic that gets you excited about it all over again.